I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 22nd of June. All things political coming up this hour with Yevgeny Feyman. He's a fellow and deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress. He writes on healthcare policy, entitlement reform, the Affordable Care Act, physician shortages, the cost of healthcare reform. He, of course, is on top of many other stories, and we will talk about all that has come to the national attention as a result of the shootings in Charleston, the Confederate flag, guns. What do we do about race relations in this country? We'll be looking at the anticipated Supreme Court decisions, one on the Affordable Care Act. Many thought some of those decisions would come today, but didn't. We'll look at the presidential race, the papal encyclical on mistreatment of our common home, and whatever else you'd like to discuss this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And Twitter is at K Dunn Show. You have Jenny Feyman. Hello again. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me again.
We're still talking, of course, and we will for some time, about what happened in Charleston. When you think of what kind of discussion needs to take place again in this country when it comes to race relations, what comes to your mind?
You know, it's a really, really thorny issue, obviously. I think there was an immediate reflexive response here to try to dismiss the shooting as either someone who's mentally ill, or even those who are well-meaning, you know, calling him a terrorist. I think first and foremost, you know, you've got to acknowledge he was a racist, and this was a racist, a race-motivated crime, a racist slaughter. And I think you know the president his comments recently was on point. You know, he acknowledged that there's been a lot of progress in race relations over the past 50 years, but certainly racism hasn't been wiped out. Now, that being said, racism probably isn't something you can wipe out. It's going to continue existing no matter how much you ban certain symbols or no matter how much you ostracize racists.
One of the discussions that has come up, of course, is the Confederate flag, some calling for its immediate removal. Evidently, that can't happen until the legislature reconvenes, and they'll take it up, I guess, in January. Is this an issue that will make its way into the presidential campaign? Is this a symbol, the Confederate flag, now of this act of horror, and that for the good of all people running for office, they need to disassociate themselves from that flag?
You know, I hope so. I don't think there's anything good left with associating yourself with a Confederate flag. I mean, no matter how you slice it, even if you think that it represents some sort of states' rights history, that particular states' rights history is one of racism. You know, we often dissociate ourselves from historical symbols that carry very bad connotations. Germany banned the swastika, for instance, mm-hmm. after World War II. And you know, I don't think going that far is a good idea. I don't believe in banning symbols, but certainly government should not be advocating or tacitly supporting these sorts of symbols. I'm not sure that it'll become a huge issue in the presidential race. Things like this tend to be forgotten over things like the economy, which are ever present. But very well might end up being a question or two. And if I recall, Rick Perry already spoke out against this, basically saying, the Confederate flag shouldn't be hanging there. So, you know, some presidential hopefuls, I think, are seeing it as a possible issue, though I think it'll remain relatively minor.
Not in South Carolina, it won't.
That's a very good point.
Yeah. The Times today, New York Times, reported that leaders of a white supremacist group that apparently had some influence on Dylann Roof had donated tens of thousands of dollars to Republican campaigns, including Ted Cruz, Rick Santorum, and Rand Paul, Earl Holt, the president of the Council of Conservative Citizens from Texas. The group is regarded as a white supremacist extremist organization opposing race mixing as a religious affront and vilifying blacks as an inferior race. Do donations like this, and I'm wondering about donations like this, you would think that when somebody receives something, or maybe it just gets lost in the shuffle, that people immediately would realize this is not a good place to get a donation from. I need to send it back.
I think probably, you know, what you said there, that it kind of gets lost in the shuffle, is likely what happens. You know, you're probably not heavily investigating who your donors are unless something about them comes to light. And it's a difficult question. You know, I think it certainly would be appropriate for candidates to actively say, you know, we're not going to accept these donations, especially given you know, the spotlight that's hit Hillary Clinton's campaign for donations made to the Gates Foundation.
Right.
I don't know that it's absolutely necessary at this point. You know, maybe saying that, you know, you're not going to accept the donations going forward. It's a really difficult question. I mean, how big are the donations relative to your total war chest also matters. So certainly, if you've got, you know, millions of dollars in your war chest, then the donations amount to a couple thousand, maybe a few tens of thousands. Giving those donations back is much easier than if you've got a smaller war chest. So that's going to play into it too. You know, fundamentally, if the American public thinks that these donations matter, they'll you know, they'll hit back at candidates that accept the donations, and I think that's perfectly fine. You know, it's that's how democracy is supposed to work.
And eventually, we'll be talking about guns again after there is a period of healing, and the grief will continue. But let's talk about guns now for a moment. I'd like your response to the president's comments. At some point, we as a country will have to reckon with the fact that this type of mass violence doesn't happen in other advanced countries. It doesn't happen in other places with this kind of frequency. And it is in our power to do something about it.
You know, again, it's a nuanced issue. Certainly, I think requiring basic background checks for everyone that's purchasing a gun is you know, it's a simple change, and it should be done at the national level. That includes, you know, not only a criminal history, but medical history, make sure that person's not mentally ill. But you know, I don't think we're at the point where we'll be able to make too much progress through legislation, just because you have millions, hundreds of millions of guns out there already. So, you know, if you start from a point where you don't have a lot of guns or you have no guns, it's much easier to make sure that gun violence doesn't explode than if you're at the point where there are already millions of guns circulating throughout the country. You know, you're talking about not only changing legislation, but changing culture too. And, you know, the point about comparisons with other countries, it's true. Other countries have much lower rates of gun violence. I'm not sure what the statistics are on other forms of violence, but it doesn't strike me as correct that simply getting rid of guns would reduce violence overall. It could very well move to other types of weapons. You could have battery, strangulations, whatnot, because you're still not addressing criminality just by legislating against guns. It may be harder to kill someone without a gun, but It requires, you know, addressing criminal behavior requires much more than legislating on gun control and making it harder to obtain guns.
Mm-hmm. And what Let's talk about the presidential race here for a moment. Does it make it difficult? I'm not sure how many. I haven't seen polls on Southern states to see how many are okay with the Confederate flag or how many people would embrace certain kinds of restrictions like waiting periods, background checks for everybody, getting guns. Is it going to be difficult for Republican candidates who've had a stronghold in the South for a long time to maneuver some of these issues?
Maybe not. You know, locally, it'll probably be easier for them if they decide to oppose the president and oppose new legislation, particularly because they're catering to their base. They get to win some more political points by standing up to Democrats, so to speak. If they find themselves on the other side of a tidal shift, though, nationally, it's certainly going to become more difficult. And I think some of that difficulty is going to happen with discussions of the Confederate flag much more than gun control. Like, again, because of the local politics, there's a massive cultural difference in terms of views on guns and gun control in the South versus other states.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch to the Democratic side for a moment. Bernie Sanders is starting to draw really large crowds. Why?
he's a great populist candidate. He says things that people want to hear, especially young people. He's distanced himself enough from some of the I wouldn't call her a blue dog Democrat, but Hillary Clinton certainly is more of a mainstream, somewhat fiscally conservative Democrat, whereas Bernie Sanders represents something that's a little more extreme, not necessarily in the in the negative sense, but he's able to identify the problems that especially young people are facing and say, well, look, first other countries have done this better, so why don't we do that? Here's a great solution. Why aren't we considering this? And it's the simplicity of the message, I think, that's so appealing.
Is there any chance that she would not be nominated, do you think?
Hillary?
Yes.
It's anyone's guess. Certainly anything can happen between now and the Democratic Convention. I still think she has a better shot than Bernie Sanders, especially when it's going to come down to debates, because I'm not sure that Bernie Sanders has thought through enough of the details of his plans, of his ideas. It's similar to what happened to Mitt Romney when he was asked about his massive tax cut proposal, and his response was really, trust me, we'll make this work. That's really not good enough for voters.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court. Everybody was expecting some very large decisions today on same-sex marriage, on the Affordable Care Act. Evidently, they're waiting until next Monday to issue those decisions. Is that significant that they're waiting until the end to give us those decisions?
Yeah, I think it definitely indicates that they're taking their time on these decisions. They understand that these are probably the most politically salient decisions, the most socially salient decisions that they'll be issuing. So they're taking time to deliberate over it, and I think that's a good sign. They're certainly aware that whenever the decision for King v. Burwell and same-sex marriage comes down, people are going to have very, very severe reactions. So mm-hmm. it makes sense for them from a PR standpoint also to wait until the end of the session.
You studied this issue very thoroughly of Jenny. What would be the ramifications for their ruling against the Affordable Care Act? Would it be chaos?
There are sort of two views on this. One view is that you'd have massive increases in premiums, and in the states that are affected, individual insurance markets would effectively fail to work. And there's some evidence for that. I think the biggest example was New York during the mid-90s and early 2000s. There were reforms made to the individual market that were very similar to what the Affordable Care Act does. And without an individual mandate, New York's individual market shrunk to a fraction of what it was before, and premiums skyrocketed, you know, to over $1,000 a month for basic HMO coverage. That's the catastrophic scenario that everyone's afraid of. That being said, there was a study in 2005 that looked at states that did have regulations similar to the ACA. No state had an individual mandate back then. And they compared those states with states that didn't. And they found that, on average, there wasn't a huge difference in the rate of the uninsured. And specifically, they didn't find any effect on insurance premiums, meaning that the risk pools didn't really get skewed by having some of the ACA's regulations without an individual mandate. So it's not clear. I think some states would probably be more catastrophic than others. Part of that just has to do with levels of competition in the insurance markets and hospital markets, how healthy the population is. So it'll vary. Some states will be more or less okay. Others will probably get hit really hard.
And what about politically? Does it hurt Republicans? Does it hurt Democrats? Does it hurt both equally? None?
I think it'll probably hurt Republicans much more than Democrats. That's probably one of the reasons why the Obama administration has been willing to kind of step back and say, you know, if anyone's going to fix this, it's going to be states and Congress. We can't do anything. Maybe from a strict legal interpretation, the administration can't do anything. But I don't think that's stopped them before. When needed to, they've resorted to fairly flexible readings of the ACA and other laws, for better or worse. And I think they understand that the political burden is going to hit red states more than any other states, because they have the largest number of subsidy eligible individuals. They're the ones where the large chunk of ACA enrollment has come from.
We're going to welcome phone calls. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 22nd of June. We still have race relations on our minds and the horrible violence in Charleston, South Carolina. The debate is beginning on whether or not the Confederate flag should be taken down in South Carolina. Continuing discussion of what kinds of issues do we need to talk about when it comes to race relations in this country? What conversations have we not had? How can this kind of event be happening? It's not 100 years ago. It's not 1963. What is the state of race relations? What do we do about it? Would you agree with the president that at some point we do need to reckon with the fact that this type of violence doesn't happen in other advanced countries? He said that he recognizes the politics in this town foreclose a lot of those avenues right now, but it would be wrong for us to not acknowledge it, that we need to think about the issue of gun violence collectively. Would you agree with that? And how do we think about it? And what do we do about it? Another act of gun violence today with very sad story of Daryl Hamilton, who used to play for the Brewers and did a fine job broadcasting last summer for the Brewers, was shot and killed by his girlfriend, and then she committed suicide. So that's a big loss as well. So what do we do about these kinds of issues? How are the presidential candidates going to deal with these issues? Will they remain front and center as this campaign goes on? The Supreme Court not saying anything about Affordable Care Act or same-sex marriage, so you'll hear both of those decisions tomorrow. Why is Bernie Sanders drawing such really large crowds? What does it say about Hillary Clinton's campaign? Is she still the foregone nominee of the Democrats? We have yet to talk about the papal encyclical when it comes to mistreatment, he says, of our common home. Well, join us, won't you? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. And we have lines completely open for you right now. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. You're always welcome to leave your messages on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655. You have Jenny Fehman is our guest. He's a fellow and deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress. His special areas, we're asking him to take on all kinds of issues this hour, but his special areas are entitlement reform, the Affordable Care Act, health care policy, the physician shortage, and the cost of health care reform. We start our calls with Marley in Wales. Hi, Marley.
Hi. Maybe a little bit off topic, but you were talking about gun control and policies that would keep people who have criminal records or mental illness from having easy access to guns. And one thing I've always wondered is, how is it that they determine if someone's mentally ill in the sense that they can't purchase a gun? Because those records are, you know, medical records that are confidential.
It's a difficult question. I'm not sure what HIPAA kind of says on that. I'm not sure whether there are specific exemptions in HIPAA to allow that. But you know, if we were to legislate some kind of new requirement like that, I'd imagine that we would make some kind of amendment to HIPAA laws, to healthcare privacy laws, to allow the background check to also look into medical records. Now, that would be limited. I mean, a lot of medical records are, in paper form. Not all of them are electronic health records yet. So there are other factors making it a little more difficult. But certainly we're on the way to digitizing medical records. So it would make it a little bit easier if we were willing to have some kind of exemption for that.
Marley, does what happened in Charleston reignite the gun debate in your mind?
I believe so. I really feel like I need to get more educated on what the gun laws are. And as I've been thinking about it, it seems to me most likely that this young man is mentally ill. And I, knowing someone who's in that position with a long history of mental illness, I wondered, now this person I know has moved to another state, what would keep them from getting a gun if they just went out to buy a gun? I mean, the person supporting themselves and not, you know, doing anything criminal, and I don't know how you would regulate that, and that was what I was curious. Are there states that have those requirements now?
Not to my knowledge. I'm not too familiar with the individual states and then what their requirements are in terms of selling guns to mentally ill people or people with criminal records. But one thing I do want to say is that we should be a little bit careful about solely focusing on those with mental illness. Statistically, they're much more likely to be the victims of crime than actually those who commit a crime. The media does tend to focus a lot on the crimes where there appears to be some element of mental illness, and you know it's a little bit tragic, I think, because in the public now we have this sense that mentally ill people are dangerous, but I don't think that the data really bears that out. I think there are other categories we should focus on much more significantly than the mentally ill. Certainly, we should not be selling guns to the mentally ill, but as it is, they're not a huge danger to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, the issue that's at play here as well is it has been in lots of racist attacks on black churches in the South, lynchings, for heaven's sake, the Ku Klux Klan. The issue of racism is really front and center here as well. It's, I mean, I don't know if you can say, well, everybody in the Ku Klux Klan was mentally ill. You know, everybody who bombed churches in the South was mentally ill. That this guy was mentally ill. He was a racist.
Right. And yeah, I'm sure at some level, if you were to take the DSM-5 and try to diagnose KKK members with some kind of mental illness, you'd find something. But that's likely not what drove them to lynch African Americans.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sordid history we have to deal with in America, that's for sure. Thank you, Marley, for your call. Eric in Madison, hi.
Hi, Joyce.
It's Kathleen.
So basically, Hello?
Yeah, my name is Kathleen. I just wanted to say that.
Oh, Kathleen?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
It's all right.
The thing that I basically wanted to say, I heard your last caller talking about this is a, mental health thing. And, I mean, whether you want to talk about mental health, whether this guy eventually gets diagnosed with some mental illness, there's a culture of hatred that gave whatever his feelings were an outlet. And that's what we need to change in approaching this country. And for so many folks who are, white Americans or folks who haven't necessarily had a part in a conversation on race, I will hear other white folks talk about, well, I didn't know slaves. I'm not a racist. But that's not the conversation for a lot of well-meaning folks that they need to be having. What we need to be talking about is education in the criminal justice system. We need to talk about the fact that corporal punishment is legal in schools that kind of map onto the old South. And we can guess how that plays out across racial lines. We can look at the fact that students with learning disabilities are asked to perform a task, not able to do it because of a legitimate learning disability, physically punished by a teacher. And then that creates all sorts of compounded psychological problems. There's real inequality in our education system, particularly in the South after the desegregation orders in the 50s, 60s. We saw in the 70s a movement of white students to private schools and a defunding of black schools, the public schools. And we're even starting to see that here in places like Wisconsin under folks like Scott Walker, who not only has he been bad on the education side, but then you also look at the low, low numbers of parole requests that he's granted, victimless crimes. And to me, that's government waste right there. Is you have, somebody who's being locked up who doesn't need to be locked up. They're not a menace to society. What they need an education, they need resources, and they need a way to be on their feet instead of barriers and, stigma of criminal records and conviction.
You have Jenny.
I think, you made some great points there, especially on criminal justice reform. We do have an agency at the federal level that I think it can be lightly said imprisons people for what many might not consider a crime. You start with simple marijuana possession and then move on to the huge disparity in mandatory minimums for crack versus cocaine. It absolutely has this distortive effect on the poor, on black communities. When it comes to education, I'm not sure it's as simple as funding streams. We know that the link between per capita student funding at a state level, and I think at the county level too, doesn't necessarily correlate with educational outcomes. New Jersey has been a great example of that, where some school districts have funding 2-3 times what others do, and yet outcomes still don't really budge. There are a lot of other problems, and they're just difficult to address solely through the school system. But so certainly there are these disparities, whether they're between the working class and middle class, or between blacks, whites, and Hispanics, minorities in general. It's something we have to be addressing. And to be honest, I don't know what the appropriate basket of policies, so to speak, would be. But starting with criminal justice reform, I think, is a good place to begin.
And we thank you, Eric, very much for your call. Michelle in Toma, hi.
Hi. Say, I'm hoping that the Supreme Court leaves the Affordable Care Act as it is. I had been on Badger Care Plus, but my husband got a raise, so it kicked me off because he made $8.43 too much. So now I have to go into the marketplace. So I just hope, since it makes me a little leery having to go in the marketplace and not knowing where things are going to fall and how much premiums and everything are going to end up going up. So I just hope they just kind of, Republicans, why don't they just tweak it a little bit rather than trying to repeal it and then don't have anything really good in its place. So that was my comment on that. And then I know I wanted to comment on gun control because some people aren't sure how the system works. But my son is 20 now, and he's severe autistic, and he's severe of the severe. So he can't read or write or color or print. I'm still teaching him potty training. I have to do all his ADLs and everything. And we had to go through a guardianship for his, you know, legality type stuff. And they took away all his rights, which I knew was going to happen. But the one right they kept in place was his gun rights.
Really?
Yes. And I tried to explain to the judge that I understand people have guns to hunt and to put food on their table, but in our home we don't own a gun because my son doesn't understand safety. He doesn't know what danger is in any way, shape, or form. And if he was ever to be confronted with somebody with a gun, with it going off, he doesn't know to duck and hide. He would just stand there, jump, and plug his ears and scream so he'd be a perfect target. So we don't have guns in our home. I don't object to other people having them. But being that he's severe autistic, he's one person with a mental illness that's bad that shouldn't even have that gun right.
Yeah. Oh, Michelle, what a hard life you've had. I didn't know that you could be severely autistic, and I would imagine it's, who knows, the laws are different from place to place. Do you know anything? It's fairly specific, her comments. Obviously, her son shouldn't have a gun, if Jenny.
Right. I'm really sorry to hear all that, Michelle. I'm not certain what the laws are, what the policies are in each state. You know, they do vary quite a bit. I think that's why, you know, you do need some national requirement for the bare minimum background checks when purchasing guns from a dealer. In terms of how you limit gun rights, so to speak, for the mentally ill. It doesn't necessarily have to be, a judge that takes away the right. I think it's enough if you have legislation that makes it effectively impossible some kind of background check. I imagine most mentally ill people aren't going to go into a gun shop and try to buy a gun. That's my perception.
Unfortunately, the few that do, there have been some very publicized and horrendous mass shootings. Look at Newtown.
Exactly. And that goes back to what I was saying before. It's unfortunate that happens, especially because it draws our attention to the mentally ill, and it creates this public perception of the mentally ill as being dangerous when they really aren't. They need protection more than. Mm-hmm. Well, much more than persecution, which it's unfortunate to say the least.
What about her comments on the Affordable Care Act, that she's on it now and she would prefer to have it tweaked?
I think that's the general consensus around the country, and I think politically, for Republicans are starting to understand that full out repeal, replace, or just repeal. May not be realistic anymore. In terms of what kind of tweaks, what kind of changes would happen, and how they would happen, that's what's going to be difficult. It's tempting to only blame Republicans for this and say that they've been oppositional throughout this whole rollout, but the administration hasn't been very willing to work with red states, for instance, that want to go. In quite a bit of a different way with the law or with Medicaid expansion. President Obama basically said that he's probably not going to sign into law certain changes that Republicans have proposed, like elimination of the employer mandate. This law, unfortunately, has a very, very partisan legislative history. You know, Medicare, Medicaid, when they passed in 1965, they passed with a lot of support from both parties. Both Republicans and Democrats voted heavily in favor. The Affordable Care Act, on the other hand, passed along completely partisan lines, at least partly because Republicans were excluded from negotiations. And that's going to be a driving factor in opposition to the law. I think post King v. Burwell, we'll probably start seeing some changes. I hope so. It may very well be at least until the presidential elections. I'll say this, though. I don't think it's likely that the Supreme Court will require the IRS to collect back subsidies that they've provided in the meantime. I think they'll likely leave that up to the IRS, and I don't see the IRS going back to people and saying, well, you've got to pay back these subsidies that you got because they were illegal. There's really no malintent from people signing up for coverage and receiving subsidies.
Thank you, Michelle, very much for your call. David from Chicago sends this email about Bernie Sanders. I think he might pull off an upset, just like the New Democrats did last month in the Alberta provincial election. And Bernie has always viewed himself as ideologically allied with Canada's NDP.
I think... What I see Bernie Sanders potentially doing, I think, is creating a kind of Ross Perot moment. I think when it comes down to the debates, he's going to end up quite a bit weaker than Hillary. But I think he has the chance of pulling away enough votes from Hillary to swing the elections towards Republicans. I don't think he's realistically got a shot right now at actually winning the presidency.
We're going to take more phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political here for this Monday, the 22nd of June. Jenny Feeman is our guest, fellow deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress. What kinds of conversations come to mind now do we need to have in this country concerning race relations? Obviously, conversations must be had after last week's massacre in Charleston, South Carolina. It also brings to discussion and the Confederate flag doesn't need to go in a museum. We also are talking about guns because the president has brought that up. We've got to get to the Pope and climate change. We'll do that in a moment. We're looking at presidential politics, what the Supreme Court didn't look at today, and we thought it might be the Affordable Care Act, but that will come down next Monday along with same-sex marriage. And you have Jenny happens to be an expert on health care, so we're welcoming your phone calls. If you'd like to comment on any of those issues or others, here's the line to get through, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org, always leave messages on our Facebook page. This is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655, our number. Jim in Rice Lake is next. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment and get your guest. I think America, we are a mentally ill gun culture, because whether it's a church in South Carolina or a theater in Colorado or a school in Connecticut, every 90 to 120 days we have mass slaughter in this country. And we have an organization known as the National Rifle Association that says if we register your guns, the government will try to take them away from you. Well, all of our cars are registered so that they can be recovered when stolen or used in a crime. And no one says the government is trying to take our car away from us. I want you to just comment, are we a society that sacrifices public safety for no valid reason? Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Jim. You have Jenny.
We do... require gun registration state-by-state basis, so it's not national. It's the same thing we do with cars. Now, maybe we should have a national database of gun registration. That doesn't seem crazy to me, but I don't think we have a complete lack of regulation of guns. Also, this focus on the massacres, it's somewhat misplaced, particularly because, you know, they're extremely tragic. But they, as a share of total gun crime, they're relatively small. You know, I think gun crime now is at around 11,000 homicides a year. You take the most publicized massacres, slaughters each year, and I'm not sure they'd add up to even 1 or 2% of that. So they're extremely tragic, and you know, this isn't to diminish how horrible they are, but focusing solely on how to prevent these kinds of massacres doesn't really address gun crime broadly, particularly because when you look at inmates that were arrested with guns at the time of their arrest, about 40% of them got them illegally or purchased on the street. Another roughly third of them got it from a family member or a friend. That those areas are very difficult to regulate. A very small share of them are purchased purely legally. So how you deal with that, it's an open question. And you know, the NRA certainly has a powerful lobbying arm, but I think figuring out the right way to address gun crime is a little more complicated than simply saying, you know, let's have a national background check and national gun registration.
We haven't talked about the papal encyclical on the mistreatment of our common home. How important was that encyclical? Is the Pope a moral authority on earth? Does his realm go beyond the Catholic faithful? And was it a good thing for him to do, or is it stepping into a realm of politics which he would be best left to politicians?
Yeah, this was very, very interesting. I think it's certainly the first time, I think, that conservatives have to figure out how much at odds they want to be with the church, with the Pope. I don't know that I'd say there are, you know, areas that the Pope should stay out of. I mean, you know, he's certainly a moral authority. He's a head of state for the Holy See. So just like any other head of state, just like any other moral authority, he can venture into whatever areas he thinks are valid. So I don't see any particular issue with that. What bothers me a little bit is the way that the Pope presented the climate issue as having arisen from some kind of excess caused by capitalism and market forces. It's a very Christian philosophy that, you know, there may be goods, goods in the moral sense of the word, that the market kind of provides wrongly, that the market can't price properly. And you know, what's odd to me is that this basically ignores the at least moderately successful experience we've seen among some countries with cap and trade systems for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, or the idea of a carbon tax that most economists support. So, in terms of identifying the problem, I don't think the Pope made a mistake. But in terms of figuring out what the solution is, I'm not sure the Pope is the best person to look to.
Barb is our next caller. Evgeny from Milwaukee. Hello, Barb.
Hi, and kudos to your previous caller, John, with his comments. Here in Wisconsin, well, here in Milwaukee, we have daily gun violence, shootings, killings, and our state legislature now is doing away with the 48-hour waiting period. And their comment, I quote, was, if you buy a gun, you ought to be able to take it home with you the same day. That's insane. The other thing that they're now approving is that ex-police officers, I mean, this is just proliferating, the whole gun thing. Ex-police officers may carry a gun into a school. Now, these are ridiculous, and it's probably the NRA all behind it. The other thing that has come up is that New York has implemented strict gun controls, and it's working. What is wrong with Wisconsin?
Thank you, Barb, for your comments. Jim on Facebook writes, as heinous as the church killings are, I'm afraid that the mainstream chatter fails to address the core issue, which in Jim's opinion is structural racism. That's something, he writes, that the majority culture is loath to address. Really, the availability of guns is not the matter. If such people as Roof can't find guns, they'd resort to something else like ammonia fertilizer, like Timothy McVeigh. Also, while hideous, that flag is not the issue, except that it's being used by a state-read public institution.
I agree wholeheartedly with those comments. That's, you know, that's the point I was trying to make before about not necessarily banning a symbol, but you know, eliminating government implicit government support of it. And you know, the issue isn't so much that people have access to guns. It's that they're using them in heinous ways that people who want to commit racially motivated crimes are gaining access to them. And it certainly goes beyond the gun debate, especially because as far as I'm aware, that Dylan Roof got his gun legally. These are going to be difficult things to address. And you know, going to the previous caller's comments about Wisconsin. So you have a 48-hour waiting period. I'm not sure what the effect of that on gun crime would be. I mean, it seems common sense to us. It sounds reasonable to say, you know, you might buy a gun in a fit of anger, and 48 hours later you might decide, you know what, I actually don't want to get the gun, and decide not to get it. I'm not aware of any literature that has found a reduction of crime from those kind of waiting periods. The decline in New York's gun crime rate also coincided with much more data-driven broken windows community policing in the 90s and early 2000s. There's been a lot of pushback on that lately, and certainly you can debate the extent to which that reduced crimes, but it's certainly not clear to me that it's only gun laws in New York that have reduced gun crime. There's a lot of other factors at play.
Mm-hmm. And getting back to where we started the hour, what does it mean for the whole Charleston incident really touched so many of us to our core? We found ourselves mesmerized by these statements of forgiveness to the shooter in the midst of their crying and their horrendous grief. The thousands and thousands of people who gathered in Charleston and marched in racial unity across a bridge. The focus on all aspects, and there are many aspects of what happened there over the last few days. Does that stay with us in some way? It was incredibly moving and incredibly horrible at the same time.
You know, I think the people who are offering forgiveness are much, much better people than I am. It's, you know, if I'm not sure how you can sit there and then forgive someone that killed a family member, especially in cold blood and with so much hate.
Yes.
But I also think it shows the resilience of the human spirit, the fact that people understand that there are structures outside of individual decisions that affect what people do. And I mean, it really is beautiful that there's such kind of forgiveness out there in the world that people can muster that. And frankly, that's in the midst of everything that's happened, I think that's a little bit comforting.
Yevgeny, thank you as always for being with us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
Yevgeny Feyman. He is a fellow deputy director of the Center for Medical Progress. All Things Political takes place each Monday at 1 o'clock. Always a variety of issues to discuss, so we'll be doing this again next Monday. Different topics, but all things political. And just a reminder, tomorrow, as state budget negotiations continue, a lot of the focus has been money on education and changes to public education in the state. Tomorrow at this time, we'll speak with a Republican lawmaker about what's driving all of the changes, what they are, and with a champion of charter and voucher schools to talk about why he is a champion of those schools. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and to KP for on-air production as well here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up. We'll return. Should we have science debates?